What is the current and future state of the IPO market? And how can companies prepare for IPOs in 2025? In this episode of the Privately Speaking podcast series, host and private enterprise partner Erica Whitmore and Jack Castle, Senior Vice President and Head of Listings for the Western U.S. at NASDAQ, discuss the anticipated rebound of the IPO market in 2025.
Well, Jack, so excited to have you here with us today. Thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to spend some time with us so we can have some good nuggets of information for our listeners here. But if you don't mind just taking a couple minutes and kind of giving us your background and your experience, that would be great.
Happy to, and thank you for having me, Erica. Jack Castle, I am a Senior Vice President here at NASDAQ and head of our listings for the Western U.S. So in my seat, I oversee both our IPO business as well as our client management, so for our listed companies. I've been here about 7 years, spent some time investment banking before that, and then fortunately had the privilege of playing baseball for a number of years, actually.
Oh,
against
great.
Your Rockies for a little while.
That is, did you say for the Rockies?
Against them. I was okay. Padres
okay.
and Astros.
That's okay. But, all right. Yeah. We'll take it. That's really cool. I didn't know that. That's awesome. My boys play hockey, but I'm a huge sports fan. So that's awesome. Very cool. Well, we are short on time, so I'm going to jump right in, Jack. So as we kind of talked about, as we were getting ready to chat today, your CEO, Adena Friedman, spoke very recently about the IPO pipeline. So, you know, we've got a little bit of background there, but would really love to hear from you kind of what that pipeline looks like, what kind of industries, even like are companies like ready to roll or is it in the future? Anyways, I gave you a lot to think about there, but tell us a little bit about the pipeline.
Yeah, broadly speaking, I think we're still very excited about the prospects for 2025 and really the IPO market's finally rebounding, beginning cautiously and then really accelerating in the second half.
Second half, that's great. That's what we've said too. So that's good to know we're aligned.
Yeah, and I think as we kind of bifurcated a bit, this first cohort of IPOs will be likely the larger private equity backed companies, just given their profile, larger scaled revenue, maybe mid to high teens growth rate, but profitable and understandable story. And as those deals get out, we obviously the market will be watching how they trade. And then we'll start to see some of the growth back companies, more your VC or growth oriented companies come into market in late Q2. And we expect that momentum really to pick up through the second half with 26 looking very optimistic for the growth companies and stories.
That is, I mean, it's like you knew what I wanted you to say like that. So everyone that knows me knows I love IPOs and I love the IPO market. And it's been really kind of tough the last couple of years, right? It's just been a tough market for IPOs in general. So I'm really glad to hear you say that. And again, pretty similar to what we've kind of said in our Venture Pulse publication. So great to hear. If I think about some of the listeners, some of the companies that will be listening to this podcast, being that kind of high growth company, right? A lot of different industries. What kind of size should they be thinking about? And I'll give you for an example. So if I'm a tech company and I'm growing pretty fast, maybe I had a year or two where I didn't have quite the hockey stick that I was looking for. What are you seeing in terms of pipeline for EBITDA as well as revenue, size for a company that's high growth in tech?
Yeah, I'd say the scaling threshold still remains high. And again, as we look back over the last few years and this new normal, investors are really prioritizing companies with, I'd say, 300 to 400 million in top line revenue. That's coupled with, 30% growth rates. And we do joke as we're talking to a lot of CFOs and CEOs that 20 is a new 40, just as the market's kind of found its balance. So if you're in that upper quartile, that's going to be very attractive to investors, especially on the public side, as they look at the public peers, and where they can create alpha. So if you have that growth rate, that's going to be attractive to them to participate either in that crossover round or at the IPO.
Yeah.
And then as it relates to EBITDA, again, that really comes down to the sector and the profile of the business. Sticking with your example with tech, companies don't necessarily have to be profitable or have positive okay. EBITDA, but they do need to have a story around that predictability and that path to profitability. So we've seen okay. a few companies go out that have traded well that are still burning on a quarterly basis. However, they are, you know, telling the story and their model shows how they will incrementally decrease that burn over the course of a few months to quarters to get to profitability in some finite time.
Okay, perfect. So switching to kind of thinking about, again, those private companies and maybe like some of the other challenges that they may be facing, what are other trends that you're kind of seeing in terms of challenges facing those companies? Obviously, I would think, to your point, right, making sure that you're growing to that revenue number that makes sense and working on your efficiency and things like that. Anything else companies should be paying attention to?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is starting this process early, 18 yeah. to even 24 months ahead of your eventual IPO. Even if you have a date range, the board's thinking about late next year. Now's the optimal time to start to put things in order. And to your point, there's going to be the operational side of this. So yep. with your readiness, your systems, you can look at your board, succession planning, just having all that pretty bulletproof. But then also a key element now, especially in these markets, is starting to meet with investors as yep. well as analysts well ahead of the IPO. And
how far ahead? That's a super important point, Jack. And I know a lot of the companies are well aware of that, but what is the timing on that, do you think, that they really need to start seriously doing that?
I mean, I'd start at least, I recommend about 18 months out.
Okay.
It's a big world out there. There's a lot of investors and a lot of dry yeah. powder. So you can start with some of your banker conferences.
Yeah.
You can start with some of those top tier investors or asset managers that are either on your cap table or you'd like them to be, and then kind of work your way down that list. But you know what it really allows companies to do is specifically the management team is just to one, start to tell that story, and just get your name and brand out there, get that awareness for the investor community. And then two, it also gives you that feedback loop. So as they have their questions around certain KPI, certain ACV or your net churn, you know, you may have those answers, but the more you hear about that as you start yeah. to tell your story, and as we know, bankers, investors, they like to put companies in buckets. And we've seen a lot of companies, yeah. especially with the acceleration of AI, and they may have, you know, their go-to-market strategy, but now they have a flavor of tech. And so they say, well, you're putting us in this bucket, but we think we either straddle these two buckets of companies or comps, right. or we feel we should be in this other one. So the earlier you can start to tell that story and start to kind of really build out the case why you should be comp to this other bucket of peers, yeah. it allows you, again, not only that feedback loop, but to start to show and build credibility then as you have your follow-ups, as you start to show, you know, work through that checklist on, hey, here's our key KPIs, here's where we expect to be over the following quarters. And then as you do those check-ins, you continue to hit those milestones and key metrics, you're just building your credibility with that investor community. And yeah. and then I'd say too, I mentioned analysts, but that's another key element, especially of going public. So all the banks have their respective research teams and analysts. The earlier you can start to have those similar conversations with the analyst community, you know, it just, again, helps them to understand your story and really make sure that you're getting the credit for what you're doing and what you will be doing in the future as a listed company.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice. So a couple follow-on questions there. So if I'm you know, part of a management team and I have done an IPO before, but it's been a few years, right? Like, how has the the investor landscape changed, right? Like, what are some of the things that maybe I need to be thinking about that I didn't in the past?
Yeah. I mean, nothing beats experience. So fortunately, you'll have the scars on the back to show that you've been through.
Good way to say it. Yep.
Yeah. I think a lot of people forget, too, that, you know, as you prepare for an IPO, again, even 18 months out and are running this process, you're also having to execute your day job.
Right. Exactly.
And so that the juggle is real for the individuals going through this, especially at the management level. I think over the past few years, one of the key things that we've seen change a bit, and it's really around not only the growth and the expected size and scale of the business, as we mentioned, but then to the group of investors that are now really playing an integral role in the IPOs, especially during the roadshow and at pricing. Now, I'd say the majority of deals you'll have a collection of long onlys, hedge funds, and then sovereign wealth funds. And each one of them are, you know, it's kind of newer buckets, but each one of them now wants the diligence, each company wants to meet with you. We're seeing a lot of crossover rounds that are coming in to later stage rounds, venture rounds or financings. That can be your, some of those, again, crossover rounds that will do the investment, but then also be there on day one. And for those companies, for the crossovers, they really want to have a good visibility into profitability.
Sure.
So that's one of their like really key metrics. And then I think those are probably the two key things is kind of the size and scale of companies and then the mix of investors that are coming into these IPOs that you're having to meet with.
Yeah, absolutely. Super, super helpful. So maybe really quick, because I don't want to ignore it. What about retail investors? What do they need to be thinking about when it comes to retail investors?
Yeah, it starts with just telling a compelling story. Retail still plays a very important role in our markets. We've seen it certainly fluctuates, especially
sometimes an outsized role, right or wrong, right? Like
it has been, yes.
In some instances, right? So super interesting.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I mean, we've seen retail up to 50% of the total market.
That's pretty impressive.
In some cases. Yes.
Okay, so can't be ignored.
It can't be ignored. And where we usually see that play well is for companies is, again, that compelling story. And then that falls into, as opposed to your investor-centric marketing, it's just kind of broadly your marketing. So as you think of that go-to-market, those functions around commercials, around out-of-home, around social, leveraging those channels to get the brand awareness out. Because again, you're not going to necessarily be meeting with retail investors, but if they start to see your brand more through the different channels, you're going to just create that organic awareness for the retail group.
And I think in my view, and I'd love to hear if you agree or disagree, you know, that's not just limited to consumer brands, right? Like, I think it's broader than that, right? There's a whole community out there that's super active and very much paying attention to everything you just mentioned, right? Social and what you do as a company. And so I do think it has to be part of your strategy if you're going to go public, no matter what kind of company you are. Again, just my view.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, any of it is going to likely be beneficial. I wouldn't recommend, you know, every company going out and get a Super Bowl commercial per se.
Fair enough.
If you're, and as you think of your CNBCs and kind of your business oriented channels as well. So not, you know, as you can do those commercials and get a lot of eyeballs on them. But if you do them through specific channels with targeted audiences, again, that tends to lead to kind of those a better ROI as it relates to your offering and kind of the investment opportunity for the company.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked a little bit about this when we were preparing SPACs. So what's the deal with SPACs today?
Yeah, I know it used to be a four-letter word.
Yes, very recently, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still an opportunity for private companies to get to the public markets. I think, you know, as we look at the overlay and our outlook for 25 and 26, we really revert back to the 2017, 18, 19 years. And that's where you had about 40 to 50 SPAC listings. It was a higher conversion rate. It was a lower redemption rate. And really that was based on just quality sponsors that were coming to market. And then also just the economics made sense. And they were also being very diligent in the companies they were acquiring or combining with. Through 20 to 21, 22, obviously there were close to 1,000 SPAC listings. So
which is just crazy.
It was just crazy. It was absolutely crazy. And so through that, there was just so much demand that you saw a lot of companies going through that weren't necessarily ready to be public companies. And I think that's a key thing for companies is, you know, regardless of the deal, whether it's an IPO or a SPAC, are you ready with your model, with your story, with the predictability and visibility in your model and your revenue streams, you know, the assets or the businesses you may acquire, how you'll invest in certain products and solutions. Story around AI across the board, all sectors, AI is a topic that comes up in every investor meeting, whether it's a headwind or a tailwind. So it still comes back to being prepared to be a public company. I think one of the differences we've seen over the last really 18 months is a key attribute of going public via SPAC was that time to market. So it was more of an M&A transaction. You'd have a pre-negotiated evaluation, you'd work off kind of a lot of times that forward guidance, and then you'd have about 3 to 4 months to complete the transaction and you were listed. Fast forward to today, you know, it's on average about 200 days from announcement to close of a SPAC transaction. So that's about 7 months. Or now you align that with an IPO, it can take, you know, once you really green light it, it can take 6 to 7 months. So companies just need to look at the benefits and the areas of concern of both mechanisms and figure out what's best for their company. But we do think that this is something we'll see more of or continue to see more of throughout 25 and into next year.
Well, and as the auditor in the room, the fact that the timeline's kind of the same and the fact that you really do have to be ready to be a public company, then it doesn't matter, right? At least from a risk perspective. So makes a lot of sense. So we are getting close on time, but I've got two additional questions. One, you know, we spent a little bit of time talking about guidance. Maybe we dive just one layer deeper on that, because I think that's important for our listeners to hear is, you know, what are companies doing? When I say companies, I mean companies that are just going public, you know, and again, last couple of years, what are they doing in terms of providing guidance and how important is that? And that's obviously leading the witness here, but super important to talk about.
Yeah, it's definitely important. And I think, you know, just from a timeline perspective, again, we say, you know, start 18, 24 months ahead of your kind of target listing day. But then as you work through that time frame, about 6 to 9 months out, you'll engage your investment banks, you'll host an org meeting. About, again, 6 months ahead of the IPO date, you'll start drafting an S-1 for a confidential submission with the SEC. You should expect a few turns of comments. So you want to give yourself kind of 4 to 6 weeks kind of per round. So, you know, there hasn't been as many deals. So it's probably taken about 20 to 30 days for comments in some instances.
Which is great.
Which is great. Exactly. Yeah. And they do
hopefully
a great job
stays.
Over there.
Hopefully that stays.
Right. And then once you have your S-1 in a good place with the SEC, that really gives you a more defined timeline. You've got that big hurdle behind you, and now you can start to look for those windows of opportunity with the market. And then as it relates to the guidance, you know, the key thing, again, we see for companies is really is providing guidance, one. And it, a lot of times that's just optics, right? Especially for new IPOs or newer companies to the public markets. And, you know, sometimes it's bad news and you need to be prepared for that. But but being transparent and being confident in where the company is and the businesses and the model is going to yield confidence in your investors. They may, you know, have different pricing mechanisms and how they value you, but being transparent and having dealing with that pain in those particular instances is again going to afford you more upside. And I think the other thing with the model is as you think of the roadshow and you think of the analyst days and really engaging there, you'll have each company will have their respective model. But usually as you go in, especially if you say you host an analyst day, you got about 30 analysts and investors there meeting with you. Each one of those firms is going to take all the numbers you give them, plug them into their own model. Right. With their own assumptions, and then have those outputs, and then they'll come back to you for the Q&A with that, right, with those questions based on their model. So you need to have yours as bulletproof as you can and just be able to talk to every single cell. Anybody that's been right. through a transaction knows how finicky they can be. Yep. But understand that that's part of their process, right? And so the more confident you are, and again, back to that predictability or visibility, in especially for technology companies, having those booking numbers, having a more seamless kind of growth pattern as opposed to lumpy. Maybe there is seasonality in your business, which is fine, right, or it's based on volume. But that's where, again, you want to get ahead of that with the investors and the analysts to explain what that seasonality looks like and why you expect maybe a slower Q2, but you have the upside in Q3 and then Q4. And yeah. So having that those conversations and getting that information to that community is only going to yield you, again, hopefully positive results.
Yeah, I mean, I think two key words there was transparency and visibility, right? And so really being able to tell that story, like you said, and the analyst really being able to understand it and get it into their model and you know, that's just super important. So I'm going to give you a left field question that we did not talk about. So we'll see how this goes. I think AI is so important, right? And you did mention, you know, having what your story is as it relates to AI, whether that's truly part of your revenue generating business or part of your efficiency, however you look at that, right? But if you look at the pipeline, is there a significant amount of companies that are in the pipeline for, you know, say 25, 26, and maybe even 27 that are AI, you know, that's where they're, you know, getting revenue from, either a bulk of their revenue or it's a significant portion? That's the first question. And the second question is, and I think I know the answer to this, regardless, if you're not a company that's part of your revenue, it has to be part of your efficiency, right?
Right. So maybe I'll start with the second question first and then get into the pipeline. So I think that's just it. Even as you hear earnings calls for public companies, right? And there's, you know, different trackers and indexes on how often people are mentioning AI on their earnings calls, et cetera. So, you know, everybody wants to know, again, is it a headwind or a tailwind? And there's really two ways to do it, right? Are we leveraging this internally from an operations and an efficiency perspective? Can we get more done with the staff we have? Can we cut headcount and get equal amount done? So there's a lot kind of below the line in the operations aspect. And then the other element is then in their solutions. So in their products, so are they able to now drive more revenue above the line through their solutions, leveraging AI? And I think it's just each company is going to have how their story and how they're leveraging it. But it is something, again, we're hearing at the public company level and earnings. It's something we're hearing for investor days and analyst days. It's something that every company should be thinking about, at least in how they'll answer that story, let alone if they're leveraging something that they can point to. And I think the second point in pointing to it is you definitely need to have credibility in what you're doing. You know, anybody can say they do AI.
Right, exactly.
But if you're putting it out in the model and all these smart individuals, you know, they have elephant memories. So they're going to say, hey, 6 months ago, you said you were implementing, you know, a certain AI element to your product suite. How's that going? What's the revenue? How has that been efficient for your business? So if you're going to say something, you know, you got to be able to back it up.
Right.
And then to your first question, just around the pipeline, you know, I related a bit to kind of when we saw the surge in mobile. And what I mean by that is we'll probably see more of the picks and shovels come into market in the
first
group or cohort. Yeah. So we're starting to see that now just around kind of the chips, the data centers, the infrastructure, the power, and then eventually we'll work our way up the stack to the application layer, which I predict would be more of a late 26, early 27, because I think there's still, there's just so much noise in that market. Obviously you have some companies that have run way out in front, but there's been so much capital put into this kind of subsector. That a lot of that needs to just continue to be teased out and to identify who the winners will be and what is their competitive moats and how are they addressing the TAM and increasing their percentage of the TAM. And once you have that, then they'll have, again, the investors as well as retail will have that conviction that this is a company that I want to invest in.
Well said, man. You wrapped that up like perfectly. Like that was that is great. Well, that is our time today, Jack. Thank you so much for coming and talking to our listeners. I think I hope they find it as valuable as I did, and I really hope that you'll join us again sometime soon. So thank you, Jack.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to KPMG's Privately Speaking podcast. And be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.